The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, tonight's story is heavily focused on SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host, Eric Peabody, and tonight we have a brand new story from J.R. Hamintaschen, a regular here on the podcast. As with most of J.R.'s stories, this one has quite the title. There's a reason why only vicious pit bulls and that asshole kid from Toy Story are named Sid. And, as with most of J.R.'s stories, the subject matter here is dark and personal. SIDS, Sudden Infant Death Syndrome. As is mentioned in the story's opening paragraph, the acronym seems almost intentionally horrifying. It's something that humans have contended with for our entire history, but we know surprisingly little about it. For Daniel and Teresa, in their mid-30s and with a brand new infant, it's one of a million things on their minds as they learn how to care for their child. But another infant in their apartment complex passed away from SIDS rather recently, and Daniel starts to become suspicious after talking with other parents nearby. Perhaps it is simply bad luck, or something that stems from an as-yet-undiscovered medical cause. But maybe it's something else. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author J.R. Hamintaschen, I give you, There's a Reason Why Only Vicious Pit Bulls and That Asshole Kid from Toy Story Are Named Sid. Is there anything more terrifying than the acronym SIDS, Sudden Infant Death Syndrome? The acronym seems intended to horrify. Even a worse fate, something like Lingering Infant Death Syndrome, might be more tragic and heart-wrenching, but not as cataclysmic in its threat of universe-disordering abruptness. The name signifies how little is known about the syndrome. You could dismissively call it shit-happens syndrome, and wouldn't be too far off from the official description. It's the diagnosis you're left with when the other causes get ruled out. There are some supposed indicators. It's most likely to occur within the first 6 months, with 90% of deaths happening within a year. So put that cake down, rest assured you aren't even in the clear at Junior's first birthday, and is more likely to affect boys than girls. Further complicating matters is how SIDS gets conflated with suffocation death, so a child who sleeps on their stomach or who sleeps in their parents' bed is supposedly more likely to die of SIDS. As if sleeping in a bed could explain why an infant's body is prone to fail. It's like they added an arbitrary element of contrived neglect to the mixture of grief, just in case anyone was foolhardy enough to tell a parent that it wasn't their fault. There's nothing they could have done. Didn't you know? You could have ensured at every moment during the night and early morning your child hasn't rolled over. What kind of parent are you? Or, one could ask ghoulishly, what kind of parent were you? And incidents of SIDS have been rising over the years. In the United States, it was approximately steady at about 2,500 babies a year. But the upward creep of incidents was obscured by the falling birth rate. Eventually, the increase became undeniable, although it's not like medical professionals were crowing about the problem from the rooftops. As if inflation, exploding home prices, and the deteriorating state of the world in general weren't enough reasons for procreative forbearance. Now this, too. One of those little curious facts about SIDS was that not only did it affect boys more than girls, but the highest incident rate was in the Northeast. That's what it said if you looked it up online. The Northeast, as if that was all one undifferentiated plot of land from Pennsylvania to Maine. While the data hadn't been broken down yet at such a granular level, a budding Nostradamus may have foretold the region with the highest rate of SIDS was Queens County, New York City, the western part of Queens most of all. It was into this reality that 35-year-old Daniel Myers and his 34-year-old wife Teresa gave birth 3 months ago to little Nathan Myers in the western portion of Queens County, New York. It's remarkable how a realization can be so inspiring, mesmerizing, and banal. Looking at Nathan's little three-month-old face, Daniel thought how wondrous, beautiful, and amazing was the love he felt for his little buddy. Yet, he was also simultaneously aware of how obvious and boring that would sound when expressed out loud. Of course you love your son, and of course your son, to you, is an unbelievable, transcendent miracle of creation. Those dimples, those big green eyes, that happy chubby face, the only time two chins would be an asset. And Daniel could look at that face and simultaneously think about how much he loved this guy and loved having been able to take a month of paternity leave to spend with him, while also being glad to be back at work to get some time away. On top of that, there was an added layer of wishing he was still carefree enough to get shit-faced drunk from time to time. He missed drinking. He knew his wife missed drinking too, although not as much as he, and above all, she probably missed her coffee since she was breastfeeding. But drinking was fantastic. That's why it was so popular. That's really the self-evident reason why vices are so popular, because they beat real life. And with the round-the-clock responsibilities of work, hurrying home, helping out with the baby in bedtime, catching up on more work while Nathan slept, then just waiting for that inevitable late-night Nathan crying wake-up, it just made him miss how much of his 20s and early 30s was spent. Not exactly partying, but just drinking the edge off whatever edge needed leveling. But no more of that. Can't get drunk now. Not with a baby you're afraid to drop, or a baby you're afraid to roll over onto in the middle of the night. At least, in their greater apartment complex, which consisted of six buildings centered around a shared courtyard, they had company to share complaints with. Two other families they knew had newborns, all going through shades of the same experience, meaning they were all wise enough not to say things like, "So, is he sleeping through the night yet?" There was Navdeep and Clara with four-month-old Angelique, and Paul and Kim with three-month-old Christopher. Angelique always seemed happy, and Daniel couldn't remember ever seeing her cry. And Christopher was huge for his age. They joked he was going to be a genius with a head that big. He was of the size that, if you found out his eventual nursery school was running an illegal baby fight club, after your initial shock, you'd be even more shocked if Christopher wasn't the reigning champion. Paul and Kim also had a three-year-old daughter, Iris, and Daniel wanted to ask if those were their actual real names or their Americanized names. He suspected Paul and Kim to be Americanized names, given that Paul was from China and Kim was from Hong Kong, but Daniel didn't know them intimately enough to ask. They all had that tenuous relationship where they wouldn't be hanging out if it weren't for the babies. They would, when time and sleep schedules allowed, hang out in the courtyard for stroller walks, their respective kids of that age where they had no concept or concern for other babies, other than maybe the curiosity of seeing some other wobbly, gelatinous creature making the same confused faces back at them. It was the first weekend in March, and the winter chill was still in the air. Daniel, Navdeep, and Paul were walking around the courtyard with their respective lumps. Paul, having an older toddler, served as a general resource as to best practices and what to expect in the near future. He refused to give a definite answer as to when they could all expect things to get easier. "It doesn't get easier," he'd say. "Just different." "We moved Christopher to his own room. Trust me, it's worth it if you want any sanity. He has to learn to sleep on his own," said Paul. "We've talked about trying to introduce Nathan to his crib and his room," Daniel quasi-lied. The crib was set up, but Nathan slept in the bassinet in their room, because best practices, that idealized Eden of a term, best practices, said you should have your infant sleep in the same room with you until he was 6 months old to reduce the risk of SIDS. Daniel didn't even really want to talk about this in the courtyard too loudly. He'd heard that another family in one of the other buildings had recently lost their newborn son to SIDS, but whoever that may be, he had no idea. He'd never brought it up with Navdeep or Paul, because who wants to think about that? When you took your cooing or sleeping baby out for a walk, you gathered warm smiles and many people saying something like, "Enjoy, Dad!" But sometimes he wondered if a smile appeared too brittle or if someone just kept their head down, whether he was passing by that rumored someone who had borne such an unimaginable loss. "Angelique usually ends up sleeping in our bed with us when it's like 2 a.m., and there's no way we can try and put her back to sleep," Navdeep confessed. He was pining for a similar confession from the others that they let their baby sleep in their bed, but he wouldn't be getting it from Daniel, whose wife made him swear not to tell others that they often did the same thing. "Whatever works," was all Navdeep got out of Daniel. Paul threw him a lifeline. "Yeah, we did that with our first, too." "I'm sure it gets easier over time, but there's just so much to always be thinking about. It's ridiculous," Daniel began. "Did I tell you about the buttered popcorn thing?" Paul looked confused and clammed up, remembering the time he accidentally gave Iris popcorn when she was 2, and she got some stuck in her throat, and he felt horrible not knowing that popcorn was considered a known choking hazard. "No, it wasn't buttered popcorn. Sorry. It was maple syrup, that's what it was. It was like a few weeks after Nathan was born and we got back from the hospital. I just kind of noticed the smell of his pee diapers, and I was like, whoa, smells exactly like maple syrup. I kept smelling it and thinking, damn, maple syrup. Maybe his first food will be pancakes or something. Teresa smelled it and agreed. I didn't think anything of it, but then I started Googling around about it. I shit you not, there's literally a syndrome in babies called maple syrup urine disease, and it's basically a death sentence. It means their body can't break down amino acids or something. And I remember how I felt. My heart and stomach felt like they just fell out of me and I was being sucked into a black hole. I start panicking, wondering how to tell Teresa and thinking, what are we going to do? And I like start crying. "Oh my God," Navdeep intoned. "Yeah, like, what else can it be? It smelled so strongly." But then I thought, wait, didn't they do a whole bunch of tests right after he was born? Like, there are all these mandatory tests they do after every child's born. "Right." Paul turned, invested in the outcome, vicariously purging his own parallel worries. "Yeah, so I checked that testing form, and they actually tested for that syndrome, and Nathan didn't have it. And of course, you tell yourself it's a miracle, and thank God, and I'll never complain about anything again." "Which lasts for about a day," Navdeep added. "If that. But there's so much to worry about, it's almost comforting how impossible it is to keep track of all the worries. It's like, oh, you have terminal brain cancer, but also throat cancer and stomach cancer, and there's a comet headed to Earth anyway, so what's the point of trying to worry yourself so much?" "I hear you," said Paul. "So, what was it? Why did his diapers smell like maple syrup?" asked Navdeep. Daniel vigorously shook his head. fucking stupid bamboo or whatever dumb diapers we were using. I smelled them without pee in them, like really got in there to take a whiff, and they just kinda smell sweet for some reason. Gave me a fucking heart attack. They should really have a note on the box or something, like, "Don't worry, your kid isn't dying, it's just the way these diapers smell." Yeah, although just wait, I bet one day some poor kid will have that syndrome and use those diapers, and the company gets sued because the parents will say they relied on what was written on the box, Navdeep added. They all shook their heads at the grim and depressing state of affairs, the only rejoinder being the inherent ebullience and promise of their fresh-faced offspring, all prostrate in their bassinet attachments, facing up toward them. Angelique sneezed snot and smiled. Christopher tried to shift in his stroller bassinet, had difficulty, and fussed loudly. Nathan stared off into the great middle distance.
"But I'm telling you," Paul said, comforting Christopher, "if you want to survive with your sanity, especially now that you're back at work, try getting Nathan to sleep in his own room. It's a game changer."
Teresa wasn't too excited about the idea. Daniel pointed out that since she was the one with Nathan all day, if anyone needed a break at bedtime, it was her. They'd agreed on most items of parenting, which primarily meant Daniel ceded to Teresa when she felt strongly about something, such as avoiding sleep training and letting Nathan sleep in their room until he was 6 months. But Daniel knew Teresa was wavering. There were only so many zombie nights one could take, only so many nights you can spend, arms rigid, practically straitjacketed in bed next to a lumpin' potato, doing everything in your subconscious power to not roll over in your sleep. She put up a good show of pretextual protest until agreeing that maybe it would be good for him, maybe there would be a tremendous miracle and he would take to it, and the bed would be theirs again. Oh, what they used to do in that bed. If memory served, fun things had once happened in that bed. Fun things that had reached their culmination, and apparent end, in the creation of little Nathan. Things Nathan shall blessedly never, ever know about. It was remarkable, really, to think about what types of pictures had been taken in that bedroom just a few years prior, back when the plan for the second bedroom was to keep it as an office or crash pad for out-of-town friends. At bedtime, Daniel held his baby boy tight and bounced him. Daniel could see in the darkened room that Nathan was smiling up at him, and while it was questionable at this age whether Nathan intended to smile, Daniel chose to believe. "You sweet little meatball." Little guy liked the rough and tumble motion, although Daniel never knew precisely how hard to do it. Nathan's warm face rested perfectly in the crook of Daniel's neck, as if the two were designed to literally fit together. Daniel felt just a hint of wet on his neck, maybe just a drippy nose, but it was as comforting as being a boy and feeling the wet nose of an adorable puppy. No, as comforting as being a daddy and holding tight your delightful son. Of course, that singular moment didn't last. Nathan eventually started crying in frustration. Then Daniel brought him in for a feeding. Then he pooped and needed to be changed. Then the snuggling and the constant motion didn't seem to work, until suddenly it did. Then came the trickiest part, actually getting the boy into his crib while still asleep, itself more art than science. The trick was to keep Nathan upright for as long as possible to minimize the chance he'd realize he was descending, then reverse course and slip him onto his back as quickly as possible. It worked. And a daddy never adored his baby more than when he was asleep. Daniel hoped the little guy was having beautiful, engulfing dreams about mommy and daddy, and milk, and being warm, and rocked, and loved. About an hour later, they woke up to Nathan's unrelenting screaming. Bleary-eyed and drained, slumped in his seat, Daniel looked around the subway car, en route to what he hoped would be a formless day at the office. He was too exhausted for anything other than water-treading dithering. And while, of course, he knew he shouldn't, he felt morally blameworthy. Dad guilt. Nathan had been screaming, and while you could hear that and say, "Sure, of course, he's a baby. Babies scream and cry, what do you expect?"
there were evident variations of screams that you just never want to hear. You think a frustrated, overtired baby scream is bad? This was far worse. This was abject terror. The yelling had fumbled them both out of sleep as if giant hands lifted up the bed they'd been resting on and threw them onto the floor. Running into Nathan's room, he didn't know what to expect, but he expected the worst. Nathan throwing up or burning with fever or some unthinkable tragedy, like that damned too-loose closet door crushing him in his crib, despite it being too far away for that to ever happen. But it was none of the above, just Nathan in his crib, on his back, flailing in panic. But why, or at what, who could know? Maybe just waking up alone in an unfamiliar setting? But he'd slept in the crib before a few times, and it hadn't been like that. What if it was something in the air? How could they ever know? The polluted NYC air, the congestion, the hothouse apartments where you couldn't even control the heat, the churn and burn of the trains and the exhaust of all the vehicles, just getting into those tiny, fragile lungs. Daniel looked up at an ad across from him in the subway car, thought for a moment this must be some smart ad that changed based on what you were saying or thinking, then remembered this was New York, where they can't even get the trains to run regularly without breakdowns or signal delays. No way anything on the train would be that sophisticated. It must just be one of those kismet moments where the world reflects back at you what you've already got on your mind. It was a public service announcement for best sleep practices for children. It showed two pairs of beefy arms, ostensibly a mother and father, placing a baby into a crib with the text ABC, alone, on their back, in a crib or bassinet. He noticed that both parents' arms were heavily tattooed and rather haggard, and wondered what species of clientele this ad was designed to reach, like the fucking morons who'd been keeping their baby tied up in a burlap sack or stuffed in a sock drawer would see this ad and realize the errors of their ways. Daniel looked around and saw another ad further down the train, showing a somber, serious person with the advertising copy, "Don't be ashamed of your drug use. Be empowered you are using safely."
"Fuck you looking at, faggot-ass bitch!"
Daniel heard far behind him at the other end of the subway car. The age-old New York City balancing act of determining whether the ambient disturbance might directly affect you. This seemed far enough away and not directed toward him, and turning his head might make him a target. He could picture himself in the next New York Post article. "Ugly new father pummeled to death on train, also shits himself." Headline could read, "Life and Death in the Big Shitty." Once again, the perennial thoughts about moving the fuck out of New York. Maybe there's the answer right there. But all the chaos around him, strangely, helped him think about things other than his dad guilt. And maybe there was some benefit to that. 2 weeks later, and they hadn't yet tried again to get Nathan to sleep alone in his room. They hadn't really talked about it, as there wasn't even anything to talk about just yet. Although, what was on both of their minds was Nathan's evident fear of his bedroom. How could a newborn fear anything? Didn't they have the attention span of a goldfish? It did truly seem that when Nathan was placed on his back in his room, either being changed or entertained, he was quicker to cry, to be on edge, to kick and squirm like he needed to get out. So rather than give voice to their projected fears, Teresa made a few comments about how he must be going through a developmental leap, and Daniel agreed, because sure, why not? They continued to get Nathan to sleep in their room, either by the arduous process of rocking or the demanding process of feeding, then tucking him into the bassinet. And when he woke up in the middle of the night, as he inevitably did, Daniel would scoop him up out of the nearby bassinet and put him between them for dream feeding. Again, Daniel could never sleep soundly because he knew the precious little squishy nugget boy was right between them. One weekend, the three of them were over at Paul and Kim's apartment for a play date with Christopher, although there wasn't too much playing two infants could do. It was called parallel play, a euphemism for two infants fiddling around cluelessly in close proximity to each other. Paul and Kim's 3-year-old daughter Iris was having the most fun with another baby in the house, offering Nathan a choice selection of Christopher's toys and clapping excitedly when he held onto one for a fleeting moment.
"If only she was that into her own little brother," joked Paul.
Daniel noticed that both Paul and Kim had framed law degrees from Columbia on their foyer wall. They were both frustrating in that absolutely inexcusable way of being attractive, well-adjusted, and unshowily successful. Paul, despite growing up in China, had the vibe of a California surfer kid and no foreign accent to speak of, having had English tutors since birth, and had left corporate law to make use of his biology degree working in medical research. Kim worked as a tax attorney, perhaps the sole unruffled tax attorney in New York. Kim's accent was slight and only there if you listened for it. Yet, despite their pedigrees, they all lived in the same apartment complex. Although, Daniel thought ruefully, he and his wife had taken out a usurious mortgage, and Kim and Paul had probably paid cash.
"Can't imagine what it must be like to have two of them. This little guy keeps us so busy," said Teresa.
Daniel and Teresa sometimes talked about having another, someday. Although, in order for that to happen, the rumor went, one must actually have sex. Maybe once things settled down.
"Having two young ones, I'm in awe that you still have all your hair," Teresa continued.
"Well, it's definitely thinning,"
answered Paul, lying. Kim was in the kitchen preparing something, despite their assurances that no comforts were needed, although Kim insisted.
"And look," Paul continued. "Chris must be stressed. After all, he's bald."
"The bald head just makes him look even more intimidating," Daniel said dryly at the massive baby.
"Cat!"
Iris squeaked, jumping around and pointing around the room.
"Cat, cat, cat!"
"She's gotten really into cats recently,"
Paul stated the obvious, reaching for her cat plushie that he expected to find wherever she was pointing, but didn't.
"Oh well," he said to no one. "She's been on a huge cat kick. Everything around the house is a cat."
"I can see that. Cats are so cool, aren't they? Aren't cats the best? What's your favorite color cat?"
prompted Teresa. "False. Dogs are where it's at," corrected Daniel.
"Dogs go woof, pigs go oink, and cats go meow meow and chicka chicka chicka."
"Chicka chicka boom boom,"
Teresa said emphatically, with the required boom hand motion. When all else fails, just quote a popular children's book. This propelled Iris into full toddler adrenaline frenzy, running around and smacking the closet door.
"Cat, cat, cat, cat goes like this."
And she turned around and leapt, danced, as Paul was reminding her in vain that
"we don't hit closets," as if that ever worked.
Daniel wondered what animals Nathan would be into. He hoped not ducks, as then he'd have some explaining to do. Whenever Daniel was playing alone with Nathan and couldn't help but rip ass, because who cares, Daniel would joke,
"There must be a duck in the room,"
to that inscrutable little face. Who was Nathan to complain? Daniel was always wrist-deep in poopy, what they called a daddy diaper.
"How's the sleep going? Have you tried the crib in his room yet? I'm telling you, it's a lifesaver," said Paul.
Daniel and Teresa looked at each other, half smiling, not sure what to say.
"A work in progress," offered Teresa.
I hear you. It always is. Everything's a work in progress. We've gotten Christopher to sleep in his crib every single night last week."
"Don't jinx it, man. The minute you say that, he's going to stop sleeping through the night," said Daniel, with well-concealed jealousy.
"I know, I know. Say that and he's going to be in our room every night again."
"Like we have to," thought both Teresa and Daniel, heavy-hearted.
"I'll get there,"
said Daniel, to sound reassuring to his wife. Teresa smiled with mock nerves.
"We hope,"
she added, tugging on her imaginary collar. These issues seemed so much less important when just joking about them and not actually dealing with them. Sleep issues paled in comparison to what happened a few weeks later. Daniel and Teresa heard it from their grandmotherly, across-the-hallway neighbor Miriam while she was leaving the apartment with her midnight-colored Persian cat, a snub-nosed cutie named Cassie. It began with an almost rhetorical, "Did you hear?" in that ambling, annoying way older people communicate, prefaced with a, "Just terrible." Their ignorance as to what she was referring to put the look of horror back on her face once Miriam realized that she now had to unveil such terrible news. "That beautiful Chinese boy a few buildings over. He was such a big, happy boy." They both shook their heads automatically in a kind of paralyzed dream state, nerves prickling, knowing the direction where this was going but incapable of comprehension. "He passed in his sleep. SIDS, they call it. Just awful. Nothing you can do. It just happens. Just awful," Miriam explained with quivering lips and balmy eyes. "Christopher?" Daniel said first, Teresa covering her eyes, tears automatic at the confirmation. "We were just... oh my God!" They hadn't heard from Paul and Kim for a bit, come to think of it. Daniel had silently noted Paul's atypical non-responsiveness to texts, ashamed to admit it had piqued him a bit, but how could anyone deliver that news? It was unthinkable. Absolutely unthinkable. There was nothing to say. It was a great, giant, black, open absence. A sinking pit. Daniel's heart started racing, and icy, deliberate sickness curdled every nerve and fiber of his being. It was the negation of all things good and hopeful, so perverse it could not be contemplated. He could pass out. He could throw up right now just thinking about it. Just thinking that such a thing could conceivably happen in this world. And that it did, in fact, happen to people he knew and liked. The boy he knew as Christopher could... It was not conceivable. It was a magic trick, just a magic trick. It couldn't be real. It just could not be. It was simply just absolutely, absolutely unthinkable. The kind of thing that justifies insanity, that almost demands insanity to survive. No one could say anything to Paul or Kim that would mean anything ever again. The world, for them, must have ceased to be. They never saw Paul, Kim, or Iris again. They'd moved, and it must have been immediate. Daniel and Teresa left them heartfelt cards, but what an unwitting mockery, how ineffective to the task could any card be? There was no funeral that they were aware of, nowhere to send anything. If there was any forwarding address, they and their neighbors didn't know it. On the day they learned the news, it had been the one time they'd splurged on a babysitter to have a weekend lunch to themselves. Never again did they want to lose sight of their boy. It was the type of thing that inspires impossible promises, like how you'll never complain about anything ever again, as long as you have your boy. And Daniel hated himself a bit, for one passing, stupid thought he couldn't control. The calculating, emotionless observation that if himself, Navdeep, or Paul had to lose a child, let it happen to Paul, since he still had one other child remaining. The news of Christopher's passing put the kibosh on any talk of Nathan sleeping in his own room for a while, but at about 5 months old, Nathan was able to roll over and was becoming too big and discontented for his bassinet. Daniel and Navdeep touched base every few weeks, often a game of text missed connections, the unspoken tragedy making get-togethers somehow too hard to bear, as if their babies should somehow be in mourning also. But just around the time they'd resolved to finally, really, and actually make Nathan sleep the whole night in his crib, Daniel, while out for a walk with Nathan in his outward-facing stroller, ran into Navdeep and Angelique.
"Looks like she's ready to see the world, too," said Daniel.
Angelique looked happy in her own outward-facing stroller.
"Yep, no more having to look at Daddy's ugly mug,"
Navdeep responded distantly, as if he had somewhere else to be. Angelique kicked her little feet and either gyrated or nodded rhythmically, as if in agreement. Nathan put his arms up in front of him, looking like he was doing Frankenstein role-playing, and waved them about.
"Yeah, your buddy Angelique. She's grown, too."
Daniel spoke ostensibly to his son in that practiced way parents really speak to each other.
"How've you been?" Daniel said, just for something to say.
"Okay. Well, actually, we're getting out of here."
"You're moving?"
"Yeah, we've had enough. We're going to become just like everyone else, you know, out to Jersey. Like everyone else with kids."
"What happened?"
"Just everything. Tired of living in these tiny apartments, you know. We need a lawn. We got Angelique sleeping in her crib, not through the night yet, but I walked into her room and saw a giant fucking bug in her crib. Can you believe it? The biggest roach you've ever seen. It was like a truck, I'm telling you. I walked into her room because I forgot to turn the sound machine on, and I see it crawling in the fucking crib right toward her, and I blink and it's gone. But it was in the crib, man. We've had enough."
Daniel could tell he meant it, because he couldn't remember hearing Navdeep curse, especially not around his daughter. Usually, people who were moving out were more tactful, complaining about the tiny apartments and other New York humiliations, since the people they were complaining to still had to return to those indignities.
"Jeez, Daddy saved you. Your daddy's a superhero." Daniel addressed Angelique, who continued looking up at the sky.
"Yeah. So everything is so expensive, as you know, so we will still be around for a bit until I can sell enough limbs to afford a mortgage and find a buyer, which, with our management company, will take forever. But yeah, we are definitely moving out as soon as we can."
"Well, we hate to lose you. Keep in touch when you do. New Jersey isn't that far."
Daniel lied. The tunnels and the George Washington Bridge to New Jersey were all congested choke points where hours gained you inches like trench warfare, and Navdeep may as well be moving to Jupiter. Daniel knew he would never see them again either.
Great, one more thing to worry about. Daniel couldn't tell Teresa the true reason why Navdeep was moving. If she heard roaches, she'd be willing to burn the apartment down with everyone else still inside. She feared roaches, all crawling things really, on the instinctual lizard brain level, a kind of hatred descended from Neanderthal times where roaches and spiders were literal giant man-eaters. When she saw a crumb that, from a distance, looked like a dead bug, she'd yelp with a panicked, "Oh my God!" And you could see the inner circuitry computing the fallout of what she may be willing to sacrifice if, indeed, it was a bug. Daniel, when he could, checked Nathan's bedroom as thoroughly as his limited time allowed. He didn't see anything out of the ordinary, no dead bugs or bug droppings or anything anywhere. He wanted to stay in Nathan's bedroom at least for the first full week while he slept alone in his crib, without alarming Teresa or coming across like an absolute helicopter parent weirdo. But he had to be careful about his reasoning so as not to give the secret away. He told her that he'd read an article that suggested the non-breastfeeding parent should sleep in the baby's room next to the crib, and he knew that was a gamble if she called his bluff. But she actually seemed impressed, and he lucked out with the timing because she was trying to normalize her sleep. She was probably looking forward to being able to spread out on the bed. He agreed to bring Nathan in at night if he needed a feeding, and that was that. Bedtime was the usual war of attrition. It wasn't an exaggeration to say that the only way Daniel got his heart rate up these days was bouncing Nathan to sleep or expeditiously jerking off in the shower. It took about an hour before Nathan was conked out and tucked into his crib at his most pliable, smushily angelic form. Daniel laid down, face first, onto the sole pillow he'd brought into Nathan's room for his own use. He barely slept these days anyway, so getting an uncomfortable rest on the floor didn't seem too bad. Nathan's room was actually darker than their own, maybe because it faced out into the darkened courtyard rather than the street. The only sounds were the familiar droning of the sound machine and the piggish snoring of the lumpy boy, who was asleep on his right side, facing the closet wall. Sometimes, Daniel went to bed just because he knew Teresa had trouble falling asleep without him, so he filled his role as a heavy blanket. Here, he enjoyed the stasis, the absolute lack of expectations. In the blackness, it was kind of like camping. It wasn't the woods, but it was a hard wooden floor.
Daniel and his friend Cleveland, a longtime friend since high school, were simultaneously starring in the new Alien movie while also reviewing it. He always wanted to say to Cleveland, "Didn't anyone tell your parents it would be weird to name you Cleveland? No young person should be named Cleveland." Daniel wanted to join in with Cleveland on shit-talking the new Alien design and the special effects in general, but watching the poor, pretty young woman squirming in agony on that dirty couch was pretty harrowing. She rolled and reached over to them in desperation, arms out and shaking, practically vibrating, as out came a surprisingly furry, tendriled face from her midsection, thickly pushing through her like a thumb through jello. The creature's entire face was out now, and Cleveland was talking shit about, "Why did they have to change the alien design?" And Daniel wanted to agree, but felt guilty at those big marsupial staring eyes. And now the poor girl was violently breaking apart. And what were their roles supposed to be right now in the movie? Were they supposed to be doing something? The pretty woman quivered and screamed as things poured out of her, one of the little marsupial friends scampering onto his hands. And goddamn, it was hot in here. And why was Cleveland... Daniel jolted and looked around the still room. It felt heavy and oppressive with uncirculated air. Had he fallen asleep? Or had he just been laying here the whole time, staring straight ahead into the darkness? His mind felt slack with the torpor of freshly interrupted sleep, and he thought distantly of his heavy-set friend Cleveland in the presence of some vaguely idealized, attractive woman, and that juxtaposition rested uneasily in his mind, made him feel unwell, like too much heavy, undigested food. Daniel rubbed his face and had trouble understanding his surroundings. He saw Nathan in the crib, now on his back, and the rise and fall of his breathing. Daniel smiled. There was no sound more charming than the heavy breathing of your sleeping baby boy. In the gloom, Nathan looked huge, the big boy. Daniel would have to lower the crib. Soon Nathan would be big enough to maybe even climb out. He looked massive from this distance and angle, broad-chested. Daniel's head kind of hurt, and he felt dehydrated. There was movement in the crib, but Nathan wasn't moving. Nathan wasn't that big. Daniel shifted on his arms, torn between that desire to never interrupt your sleeping son and an urgent need to understand his son's position in the darkened crib. There was a sudden... Yes. There, yes, he saw it. An unmistakable, sudden bolting movement, like a piece of corporeal dark was stripped from the air and flung against the far wall. Daniel stood upright, absolutely still, blinking. It was so easy to tell himself it had been nothing. There was nothing, just him standing in the dark so he could see his son on his back, sleeping. But he'd heard something. For an absolute beat of a second, when it hit the wall, he heard something like soft pads gripping. Oh, God. It was going to be a cockroach, wasn't it? It was going to be a big, giant, flying fucking cockroach. And, oh, God, there was a giant, flying fucking cockroach in their apartment, and it had been on their son. He was already impressed with himself how he was quieting down that panic, because what he'd seen must have been a trick of the dark and him groggily emerging from a dream state. Because what he thought he'd seen was bigger and thicker than a roach. And just before he realized that wasn't exactly a comforting thought, he thought bizarrely but so naturally of Iris with that slurred toddler elocution. "Cats go meow and chicka chicka." Soft pads gripping. Soft feet moving. Not like chicka chicka, but like something. And toddlers hear one thing and say another. Tap, tap, chicka chicka. To turn on the light or not. To glide with inertia, reassure himself of the obvious, that this was all a big nothing, because this was reality, the real world of New York City apartments. Just keep the light off and let your son sleep.
You turn the light on, and you wake him up, and you destroy the night. And for what? There's nothing there.
No, because you know that's all bullshit. Your stomach is telling you that wasn't a bug. But what could it be? You have no answer. And the time for thinking was over. Daniel pounded the light with his left hand. The speed and almost grace of what he witnessed, he turned his head to track something that practically flew across the floor, and he could swear it disappeared into the closet. Daniel was leaning forward into the closet, both wanting to figure it out but desperate not to, and he thought he heard a noise, almost like a hissing. It was so brief it could have been just some adjustment of steam in a pipe, and he dismissed it almost like he knew the hiss wasn't meant for him. But for who? He kicked at the corners of the closet like he was stamping at bugs he knew weren't there, like an order for his unseen interlocutor to come out and show itself. Daniel was in it now, lighting up his son's room and kicking at the walls. He was in it now, that's for sure. He better have a good explanation cooked up. Nathan stirred, that sleeping, eye-rubbing, wrinkle-faced baby stirring, where confusion delayed the cry, and he forgot about everything else and was so glad to be with his little guy again. Daniel scooped Nathan up, cradling him against his shoulders, soothing him. Teresa pushed open the door, bleary-eyed at the light.
You got him?
She hadn't understood or heard everything, Daniel realized, coming in just because she saw the light on and figured he was having trouble getting Nathan to settle.
Yeah, I got him.
Daniel could save face. He could say nothing and just pretend to himself, because it was so easy and natural and expected to just keep pretending like he hadn't seen anything abnormal. He was still canvassing the closet, the room, looking nervous and suspicious, almost like a suspect telling the cops, sure, everything was fine, meanwhile keeping an eye out to make sure his partner got away with the stash.
I think we should get out of here tonight.
Daniel came out and just said it, the point of no return. He knew he would need to choose his next words very carefully, always a tall order when soothing a tired baby. Fortunately, Nathan was calm, in that liminal state, his awake body just a half step behind his sleepy mind. Teresa looked expectant in that terrified, frozen way, when she already knew what was coming and was just antsy to get the confirmation. Bugs. He saw a roach. She knew it.
I think somehow...
Daniel was going to say that an animal had gotten in there, somehow, but hadn't decided on which... And there was a scampering sound, wasn't there? Could everyone just stop for a moment? He needed to fixate and listen. Yes. There was a scampering in the walls now. He could swear by it. Very subtle, but he could hear it.
Daniel?
Teresa looked at him like straight, unadorned fear had turned corporeal and was about to burst from her chest, as if he was intentionally delaying an explanation just to torture her.
Daniel?
And she put her hands to her mouth. Whatever self-control she should exhibit to maintain calm in front of the baby was going to be wishful thinking. He knew he could never say this out loud around her, but it surely wasn't a coincidence that whenever he'd watched a video on YouTube about stoicism, there'd always been a man doing the talking.
It's okay,
Daniel assured her blandly, a lost cause, just hoping she wouldn't rile up Nathan, who was back to sleep. He was afraid to turn off the light, he realized, because with the light off, what would they do? Navdeep, he thought. Angelique slept in a crib, by herself in her room. She wasn't safe. Daniel knew he was spiraling, galloping to bizarre conclusions by leaps and bounds, sleep fatigue blitzing his brain. Iris and the kitty cat in the closet. Her poor baby brother. Angelique and the mysterious bug, SIDS. It made no sense, but he was telling himself, get out. Daniel was subconsciously replaying what he'd seen, and it had been a shape moving toward Nathan, a furry, lithe shape that was going to smother him. he'd successfully panicked himself. "Let's go into our room with him. He can sleep with us." Daniel compromised without thought, buying time to think. "Get him out of this room," he thought. "Have us both watching over him. Maybe sleep with a light on. Tell her it might scare away any bugs until tomorrow, and then we can get out of here." No, get out of here tonight, he thought. Get out of here now. "Here, can you take him into the bed?" Daniel asked, handing Nathan off to her, and she took him without complaint. Maybe delicately caring for her son would focus her mind on something productive. "I just want to check on something," Daniel said, thinking of what he could grab just in case. Just in case what? He had to think. Couldn't grab a frying pan. That would be crazy. Heavy shoe, maybe? A blunt weapon and cleaning spray, he thought. He once used cleaning spray to take down a flying roach years ago, mucked up its wings. He was too tired to be thinking entirely straight, but he knew they kept the cleaning spray in the bathroom vanity. They'd moved it from the bottom of the kitchen cabinet in anticipation of when Nathan would start opening doors. He turned on the light in the cluttered small bathroom, saw a slim paper towel roll on the shelf above the toilet next to the toilet paper, and by the sink, among the deodorant and nail polish and the toothbrushes, there crouched, about a foot tall, a grotesque furry thing, pencil neck distended, reptilian black tongue circling the top of an open tube of toothpaste, chewing laboriously and inefficiently, a creature evolved to take its time, not designed for the light. Time stopped. His blood froze. And in that bright burst of light, there was a miscommunication between what he saw and what his brain could comprehend. The first thought, bizarrely and pathetically from his past life of watching movies, was that this special effect looked so real. The creature kept working on the toothpaste, now lifting it in a small hand obscured by its fur. And God, was it ugly! It was repulsive, more like a bug than a cat. Though it did, he saw, have cup-shaped, pointed-tipped ears. Daniel held his breath, looking around quickly for some type of weapon. He saw nothing, and wondered why the animal didn't just flee in the light. He was encumbered by so many thoughts. What to do, ruminating over some deeper knowledge that this wasn't the same creature that had been in Nathan's bedroom. Hissing. There'd been a hissing. And he heard a scream coming from his bedroom. Teresa, thankfully, he thought instantly, better than the desperate, helpless scream of his son.
Daniel!
Immediately following came the groggy, frustrated cries from his son. There'd been a hiss. He had heard it. The game was up. The thought sailed atop the rising panic. The game was up, and they knew they'd been caught and were coming out in full force. The beast at the sink was looking at him, still holding the toothpaste, showing no sense of nocturnal panic. It lurched slightly forward, and two things happened simultaneously. Daniel slammed the door shut, and the creature launched itself. Daniel was quicker to the punch, and he heard the soft padding of its feet behind the door.
"There are things in our room!"
Teresa rushed over to him, holding their red-faced, full-bore crying baby.
"Take him! I'm sorry, take him!"
She needed to catch her breath. She looked so hysterical she might drop him. Daniel knew he needed to steady himself, stay calm if he could. This was a pivotal moment. Teresa made the majority of the meals, did most of the planning, the logistics, was usually even better at staying calm when Nathan was sick, or it was unclear why he was upset. She was generally capable in most things, but not moments like this. "We gotta get out of here. Just get out of here. And once we're out of here, warn Navdeep," Daniel was muttering to himself for no purpose. "It's okay, little buddy. It's okay." He jostled Nathan over his shoulder. He couldn't stand to see the little guy's slit-eyed, tear-stained face, flushed tomato red with that big, gaping, crying mouth. A howling baby never made anything easier, and of all the chaos going on around him, it was that shrill, gut-wrenching crying that most set his frazzled nerves aflame. Babies evolved to be cute, because if they weren't, our ancestors would have thrown them off a cliff the first instance they let out one of those shredding cries. Teresa unthinkingly turned on the living room light and meant to scream, but there was a pause where she simply couldn't breathe, where her face did the screaming for her, and when it finally came out, a beat or two after she'd intended, it had redoubled in volume. Two of them, upside down on the ceiling, one on the couch, another coming down the wall.
"Take him! Take him!"
Daniel shoved Nathan into her arms, football style. He ran into the kitchen and came back a second later with a meat cleaver. Thank God it was actually in the drawer where it was supposed to be. He ran back to where he'd been standing, in between his family and the things. His mind told Teresa to shut up in case she fretted about the meat cleaver being too close to Nathan. Now's not the time. Although she wasn't saying anything, just curling Nathan into her to better protect him. These things weren't backing down, he realized, and they weren't being particularly subtle. The lights were on in the apartment. Why weren't they fleeing? Alley cats flee in the light, and fucking roaches flee in the light. Maybe they weren't used to being caught, this being some kind of territorial impulse or some swarm reflex, or just simply uncharted territory. They were still, gauging him. He heard a scuffle under the bathroom door, that weirdly distended, dark, feline, buggish head peeking through so nonchalantly, the rest of it following like it was nothing.
"Fucker!"
Daniel yelled, and slam went the butcher knife. And holy fucking shit, he got it while it was still navigating under the door, right in the fucking neck. It hissed, screamed, and shot forward. He panicked in fright and anger, the way you do when you swing at a cockroach. We're sure you got it, but somehow now it's across the room. But no, the only part of it that shot forward was its fucking head. He'd gotten it with such force that its elongated head shot forward on the ground in a clean break, the area under the bathroom door so quickly full of blood it was like a magic trick.
"Oh!"
Teresa yelled nonsensically, shielding Nathan. Daniel's heart pumped with unnatural vigor, and he felt healthy for the first time in forever. He wanted to yell, "Did you fucking see that?" because he liked nothing more than credit from his wife that he was doing a good job. He swung the butcher knife with both hands at the nearest creature on the couch. He had to swing low since the couch was below him, and the animal parried easily, and now there was no turning back. He was fucking in it. This was war. The two on the ceiling began to run warily, but the one on the wall climbed halfway down and then launched itself at him. And before he could estimate its arc and realize it was going directly toward his face, its bizarrely hairless underside made contact with his lips. They felt a texture like a cow's udder, and he instantly jerked back and swung the knife like a hammer, blade down, and clipped it mid-body. It gashed and twirled, spun in the air with fur flying, and landed on its neck, yowling and discombobulated. Is that what it had in store for my son? That hairless underside to smother and asphyxiate babies for no evident purpose, not even to feed? Is this what happened to baby Christopher? Is that what they'd had in store for my son? He was stomping, stomping, stomping the little bastard, mangled body and crunching bones not stopping him. Daniel grabbed his wife with his free arm, hugging her and Nathan, and led them to the front door. Part of him wanted to push them out of the apartment, come back here and see how much of the job he could finish. But his wife held on to him, and he could see his son's crying turning more to confused interest at the spectacle around him. This was going to be quite the story for the little guy. Teresa unlocked the apartment door. Daniel had his back to her, eyes on the horde, spreading out before him in a half circle. One of the creatures, fur less pitch black and a bit mangier than the others, approached and sniffed at the shattered corpse in the living room. As if to pop the balloon of his dormant machismo, he saw, in the corner of his right eye, more of them coming out from the darkness that led to their bedroom. Four of them, at least, with more coming. Okay, he said, keeping an eye on everything as best he could, half not believing they were actually getting out the front door. They were making it. They were actually going to make it. Teresa was out the door now, Nathan cradled in her arms, no longer crying, but back to looking sleepy. Now Daniel was out the door too, exhilarated, the door slamming closed. Teresa was going straight for the elevator. It was lighter out than he realized. The normal, real-world day must be starting. Daniel was thinking tired, nonsensical thoughts, and he turned, and oh shit, he punted the creature crouched right in front of him.
Cassie!
Miriam, their elderly, across-the-hall neighbor, yelled. She looked at them in horror, then saw Daniel, wild-eyed, blood-splattered, and holding a butcher knife high up in the air. She hoisted up her hissing Persian as fast as she could and fled, bewildered, into her apartment.
Sorry?
Daniel yelled. He had just kicked that cat in the fucking face. Why was she out so early with her cat? He wanted to protest, but it was a weak defense. They didn't have anything with them. No diapers, no stroller, nothing. They ran to Navdeep's building, buzzed up. Come on, come on, come on. And he finally answered. And Daniel told him to grab whatever shit he could as quickly as possible and get the fuck out of there. Trust us and meet us. And Navdeep and his family did. And like Daniel and his family, they ended up moving out. They say that moving to New Jersey is a type of absolute death sentence. It is. Daniel and Teresa moved upstate instead. And after his performance that night, no way would Teresa deny him another child. You've been listening to There's a Reason Why Only Vicious Pit Bulls and That Asshole Kid from Toy Story Are Named Sid by J.R. Hamantaschen. J.R. Hamantaschen is a writer of short stories, having released several collections, including A Deep Horror That Was Very Nearly Awe, with a voice that is often still confused but is becoming ever louder and clearer, and You Shall Never Know Security. You can find collections of his work at Velux Books. Wow, a story with a positive ending for a change. Then again, I suppose it's not really appropriate to refer to any story with a dead child as positive, but you know what I mean. You take your wins where you can get them. Thanks to J.R. Hamantaschen for tonight's tale. If you enjoyed this one, I've covered a few of his other stories as well. Check out Season 11, Episode 6, Season 10, Episode 7, and Season 9, Episodes 19 and 5, to name a few. Also, thanks to you fine folks for joining me tonight, and I hope to see you all back next week for more Horror Hill. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.